So this week, Baruch Hashem, we are going to be celebrating 67 years since the great gift, the founding of Medinas Yisrael. And I wanted to talk with you this morning about an aspect of the state of Israel. And I went back and forth in my head because once you've been observing and celebrating for 67 years, so some of the issues that I thought that we should maybe think about discussing seemed a little bit old. You know, the debate about the halakhic question about halal or different kinds of observance, some of those things, they've been discussed so many times. So I wanted to talk about an issue which is very relevant today and will continue to be relevant. And in some circles, it is a controversial question. And what I wanted to do is not give you my own perspective, because I don't really have one. I'm still learning and researching and thinking and studying. But as always, just to share with you some sources, some primary sources, and we could think about them together. Because, as you know, I'm not a great scholar. I know not so much, but I love to learn, and I want to share that learning with you. So the question that we're discussing today is the role of Torah sages in the running of the state of Israel. What is the role of rabbinic scholars in the function of and the operations of and the decision-making processes of a modern democratic state? That's the question.
In 1 hour?
47 minutes. So this comes in the backdrop of a bigger question, which needs one preamble. There is an old saying that we use in different contexts called, it goes like this, Histakel be'oraisa ubara alma. It's an Aramaic statement which says, God, Histakel, he looked into the Torah and he created the world. What that means is that for us as Jews, we understand that the Torah in the totality of its divine wisdom, is the basis for everything in the existence. It's not that the Torah informs everything that is around us. It's that the Torah is the basis for everything that exists. All of the laws of physics, all of the trends that exist in human conditions, all of the basis of every scientific observation, it's all rooted in the divine wisdom that created the blueprint for this world. There's no such thing, when you think about it from a pure Torah perspective, there's no such thing that's outside of the realm of Torah. And if we were to be so able, if we were really able to tap into the purity of Torah wisdom in its entirety, in an unfettered, undiluted way, we would understand everything about all areas of existence, everything from everything. But the reality is that today we don't have that capacity. So usually what we'll do is we'll augment our, what we would bifurcate it almost between the Torah knowledge that we have, and then we add to that with secular knowledge, outside knowledge. But really, had it been true that we really would have understood Torah on its purest level, now, and this can be broken down into two planes. On the simplest plane, it means we wouldn't have to study geometry, because if we really understood the laws of the sukkah, and for people like me who are math challenged, so these areas of shas are always very difficult. You have people in this room who are like really math type of people. So when they open those pages of the Gemara and you see those, the first thing that I do when I see those circular diagrams and a page of shas and they have arrows, and I know this is, I start running the other way, because they're essentially doing all kinds of advanced geometrics to figure out ratios between squares and circles when it comes to laws of kilayim, for example, different patches of ground. So in theory, if you really understood, but it's much deeper than that. It's on a much more fundamental and almost mystical plane, which is that everything comes from God. And that somehow, whatever that means, that Yisrael v'orayis v'kud shabrichu chadu, that God and the Torah are one, so then that sets the basis for all existence. So on one level, Torah is everything. On the other hand, we find an important distinction that appears geographically in the Beis HaMikdash, that there were two different areas. It's strange, but if you actually think about it, there is a piece of the Beis HaMikdash that's missing. part of the Mizbeach was constructed like a box with different layers, and then it had a ramp. But the box part of it, one piece didn't have a base. Right? You imagine, like you see around the building here, let's say around this room, you see there's a baseboard. So imagine that there was a chunk of the baseboard that was missing. So why was there a chunk of the baseboard missing? Because the Gemara says that the Beis HaMikdash had to be divided between Yehuda and Binyamin. And that those two areas couldn't overlap. And because the precision was such that the way that the division of these tribes broke down, the Mizbeach had to be on one side. And if there would have been even a baseboard, it would have overstepped its bounds, so to speak. So why is there this distinction? So this is an age-old discussion about the balance between religion and state. Because the Beis HaMikdash is the makom, the place of the service, the worship, the religious worship of Hashem. And there is also, it's also the capital of the Jewish, so to speak, the Yerushalayim is the capital of the Jewish national state. And those two things, while they are abutting each other, they are distinct from each other. And Shevet Yehuda, which represents the political leadership, and Shevet Binyamin, which is the home of the service, which is the role of the Kohanim, because the Kohanim didn't have land. So this is how it's going to break down. They have to work in tandem with each other, but they can't step on each other's toes. Akadekach, that the baseboard had to be removed so that they wouldn't be overlapping. So it's clear to me, and this is part of what the Ramban explains, Nachmanides explains about what the Chashmonaim did wrong after the Chanukah miracle, was that they took over the role of political leaders. And what ended up happening in the end of the second Beis HaMikdash? So everything went down the drain because these Kohanim became the Malachim, and then the Kahuna became a political pawn. Where does the third piece of this puzzle fit in? And that's something that we want to think about now, which is, you're right, the Beis HaMikdash was the place where the Melech would come, and the Melech was the only person who was ever allowed to sit in the Mikdash, and it's the place where the Kohen did the Avodah, but there was something else in the Beis HaMikdash. And that was called the Lishkas HaGazis, the office of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin were not political figures, and they were not Kohanim. They were rabbinic scholars. They were Torah giants. So how does that fit in? Where do they fit into this picture, these rabbinic scholars? I apologize for not having enough packets. Baruch Hashem, next week, Mitzvah Hashem will have enough packets. So where do they fit into this puzzle? Where does the Sanhedrin, the great rabbinic assembly, fit into this question of political leadership? How do they relate to the malchus and the political functionings, the governing? So that's the first big question. This relates to another macro introductory question, which is what we call today, in parlance, we refer to it as called Das Torah. Das Torah, which is a very vast topic about which I don't know that much about. There is an article that Rav Lichtenstein wrote where he has one footnote with about 10 lines of articles tracing the development of Das Torah, of this concept. The concept, which is the second kind of big question, is how do we view rabbinic sages and their input outside of the realm of halacha, and perhaps even outside the realm of hashkafa, but certainly outside the realm of halacha. So there are many different perspectives on this. And this is also an introductory comment because it does have a lot of bearing on this question that we're dealing with about the relationship between Torah sages, Torah knowledge, and the running of a secular state. But it's much more global. It affects, and people today deal with this on a regular basis. Some people, when they have medical questions, they call a rabbi. Approaches like this, and it's not for us to judge somebody else. We have to figure out the proper Torah and Mesorah for ourselves in our lives. You have people before they make business decisions, they call rabbinic personalities, and it breaks down into different ways. But this also is an important question, and there are different ways of looking at this. On one hand, and this is the first source that I shared with you, kind of just a very thumbnail sketch of the different approaches. The first observation is authored here by Rav Elio Dessler. In the Michtav Me'elio, Rav Dessler writes what he calls a letter regarding Emunas Chachamim, What's the context of this letter? The context of this letter is someone approached Rav Dessler, and if you don't have a packet, it's okay. We'll be able to deal with it outside. Someone approached Rav Dessler with a discussion, with a question, with an observation regarding the Torah giants of the pre-war era. And wait a second, what would have been had the Torah giants of Eastern Europe in the teens and 20s had they told their followers to go to Eretz Yisrael? What would have been? And then the questions, you know, it's the Monday morning quarterbacking. Had they told them to go, would they have survived? Maybe they wouldn't have been murdered by the Nazis and the Germans, etc., etc., etc. So Rav Dessler writes back in a very sharp way. Part of it touches on the theological question, which is if the Rabbonu Shalom had decided, had decreed that these people, for whatever reason, which is beyond far beyond the discussion today, or even beyond the parameters, whatever. So that's not so much what he's talking about. But then he says, and he goes on to this discussion, essentially about this concept, which is a relatively new phenomenon in the lexicon of Torah life since the last few centuries. These great rabbis, and he describes the greatness of some of the Rabbanim, Rav Chaim Brisker and Rav Baruch Ber and the Chavetz Chaim, and how essentially it's impossible, it's inconceivable, based on their incredible insight and wisdom, and perhaps, and this is where it gets interesting, the idea of their almost superhuman insight to question their judgment on this question. So here you have a non-halachic question, whether or not Jews should stay in Europe or not, and Rav Dessler is deferring in a very strong way and essentially saying you can't question these great gedolim, and it's part of a bigger observation from one perspective regarding this idea about Das Torah. It comes from a pasuk in Tehillim in Perek Chaf Hei. It's called Sod Hashem Liyareyav. The word sod, what does the word sod mean?
Secret.
Right, a secret, but also means a cadre. It's the same, it comes in the same word. When you have a sod, it's only known by a small group of people. So it's among their closest. So Sod Hashem, the secrets of God, and his small circle is Liyareyav, to the people who... So the Gemara invokes this in different ways, and one way that the Gemara invokes this very interestingly is in page 2, is the Gemara in Sota. The Gemara is discussing, in an agadic context, a certain illness called Padagra. Padagra. So, we're not sure what this Padagra was. Hechi dami Padagra, the Gemara wants to know. So, omele kemachat bebasar hachai. It feels like, this ailment feels like a needle sticking into live flesh, into a human being. So the Gemara says, Mina yada. How did this rabbi know what it felt like to have this illness? So the Gemara gives you three answers. The first one is, Mechash havachashbe. He had that illness, so he knew what it felt like. The second answer is, Ika da'ami mirabe shamale. He heard it from his Rebbe. And the third answer, V'ika da'ami sod Hashem liyareyav. So now, sod Hashem liyareyav is being applied in this very general context. Elsewhere in Shas, it's applied as a discussion about Ben Azai, about a certain halachic shir. So there the Gemara invokes Sod Hashem liyareyav, but here it's even more broad, because here it's not a halachic statement. It's a statement about a phenomenon, a natural phenomenon, that perhaps this rabbi never even experienced physically, but the Gemara says it doesn't matter. Because according to one of the three opinions, Sod Hashem liyareyav, his Torah personality would understand, I don't want to say it's Ruach HaKodesh, it's Nevuah, however you're going to define it, the great elevated spiritual state of this rabbinic figure says Sod Hashem liyareyav, he'll understand that. So one perspective about Das Torah Bechlal is that this is something that when you're at that level, which is a further discussion, who is at that level of Das Torah, then this opinion exceeds beyond the boundaries of Halacha and Hashkafa to all matters in the world. And then there's an opposite perspective, which ironically is articulated in this letter, it's referenced by Rav Lichtenstein in that article that I mentioned. I thank Rabbi Metenki for sharing this article and some of the sources with me. This letter is a section Siman Chav Beis in Igeres HaKodesh of the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe says, "My dear friend, my beloved, I have to tell you, on line number 4." Mimos olam va'aye efo matzasim minigze be'echad mikol sifri chachma Yisrael harishon of acharonim. Where did you find this practice, says the Alter Rebbe? Lios minag v'tikun lishol be'etza gashmius kedas ma la'asos binyone ha'olam hagashmi af le'gedole chachma Yisrael. He says, who ever heard of such a thing that someone talking about their business dealings is going to call a Rebbe? A Rebbe is there to give you spiritual guidance. He says, look in all the Mefarshim. This is the Alter Rebbe of Lubavitch. So I don't want to, it's an interesting observation. But the Alter Rebbe says, whoever heard of such a thing? You go to the Rebbe when you have a Shaila in Kashas, when you have a Shaila in Hadracha, when you want to know about, Ruchnius. But for Gashmis, he says, we never found in the Gemara, the Chachmei Yisrael, the Amoraim, who knew everything about life and everything about the world, anybody ever went to ask these questions? You know where they went? They went to Nevi'im. If you had a Navi in your neighborhood, you would ask the Navi.
What was the context that he was saying that?
So I don't know. It's a letter, so it's hard to know who was asking, why they were asking, what they were asking about. Mm-hmm. But this observation is pretty interesting, and it goes to the other end of Das Torah, spectrum, which says, Chachamim are experts and giants in the realm of Torah, in the realm of Halacha, in the realm of Hashkafa, Ruchnius, but when it comes to matters of governance, military, these kind of things, where does it fit in? And then there's the next letter, this I thank Rabbi Ehrenfeld, this is a fascinating letter from Rav Avram Yitzchak Bloch, who was... See on the title on page 4. Av Beis V'Ram Be tells. He was asked by Rav Shimon Schwab from Baltimore. He was a rabbi in Baltimore for a time. The leader of the German community in Washington Heights. He was asked by Rav Shimon Schwab. This is in Tuf Reish Tzadi Dalet, 1934. He was asked by Rav Schwab regarding the study of secular studies. One interesting observation, we're not going to go through the whole letter because it's not right now, it's not our discussion to talk about learning secular studies anywhere. But what's interesting is the way that Rav Bloch answers Rav Schwab regarding the question in general. Because he says, look, interestingly, he says, Al dvar she'elas malas kvodu levaris ha'horo benogea lilmod chochmas ha'amim. What about the learning of secular studies? He says on the second line, and where I put the bracket, kasha, it's not easy. Kasha ma'od b'inyanim elu ke'elu lahashiv tshuva brura kahalacha. Ki inyanim ke'elu benuyim harbe ma'od al hashkafos v'deos hamikusharos im chelek ha'agada. So there's a difference between halacha and agada. So when it's not a halachic matter, it's difficult to say a psak. An unequivocal psak that goes across the board. Aser mutter. Chayav putter. It's not like that. It's like in Yane Deos and Midos. She'af she'yesh behem kama esen v'lav mikol zeh ein lekvoa behen masmeris kamo b'chelek ha'halacha. Even when it comes to hashkafic matters, says Rav Bloch, it's not the same as in the realm of halacha. It's not the same that you can give a simple psak. And that means, by the way, that it could change with time. It could be that Rav Bloch's view of secular studies and tells was one thing in 1934, and then the tells of Rosh Hashiva will say something different in 1954, and then in 2015 he'll say something else. Because it's not the same thing as halacha. And Kal V'chomer, certainly when it comes outside the realm of Hashkafa, when it comes to other areas, it's difficult to say that there's a psak. The medical psak is this. What kind of medical psak? You can't speak about a psak in medicine. Or the psak in the military is this. So these are just kind of some general contours regarding the question of Das Torah. So there is, you're obligated to ask for Das Torah for everything, and the great Chachmei HaDor, which we haven't defined, we won't define, We'll have some input on that. We're obligated to listen to that. The other side will say that we're obligated to follow everything when it comes to a shaila and halacha, but beyond that, we're not obligated to ask. And then you have a question in the middle, which may be, okay, maybe we're not obligated to ask, but maybe they have such great wisdom that it's kedai to speak to them anyway. Wouldn't that be a sensible thing? So this is a third. These are the three approaches Rav Lichtenstein outlines. Yeah?
When he says hashgachas, are we talking about agadaka?
Yeah, we are, because in the Gemara, you find lots of different agados, which often, and same thing in the Medrash, often have contradicting perspectives. So the areas of agadata are not always as crystal clear, and the methodology for deciding matters of agada depends greatly, varies greatly. So here are two cases that we could think about when we talk about relating to matters of state from a, you know, rabbinic involvement standpoint. So here's a story, interesting story. The Gemara says, the Medrash in page 5 regards Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. We know that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had common dealings with the Roman government of his time. Frequent dealings with the Roman government. So what does the Gemara say? The pasuk says that Esav said to Yaakov, "Let's go together." Yaakov says, "No, you go ahead. I'm gonna go myself. I'm not gonna take your guys." And Esav says to him, "No, I'll send some people with you." And Yaakov says, "No." So on that pasuk, "Bikesh l'alavosu v'lo kibel alav." Yaakov says, "I don't need your people to come with me." Rabbeinu, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, kahava solek l'malchusa, when he would go to visit Rome, have a mistakel bahada parshasa. He would look into this parsha. Imagine, before he went to Washington, before he went to lobby, you know what he would do? He would open the Chumash. Interesting. He would look at the story of Yaakov and Esav and their interaction, and he would look at that not from a halachic standpoint, but from a Musar standpoint, from a Hashkafa standpoint, from a Tanakh model standpoint, and say, okay, what can I learn from this today for how I'm going to interact with the Romans? And you know what he said? He said, you know what? Yaakov Avinu in those days, interesting, said, Esav, I don't want you to take anybody away and send them with me. I'm going to go alone. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, v'lo have a nasiv aramayim. So you know what? When he went to visit the government, he didn't take a Roman attachment with him. Right, because otherwise he would need a bodyguard or somebody to go with him to ensure his safety on the road. But just like Yaakov Avinu said to Esav, don't send anybody with me. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did the same thing. He said, don't send anybody with me. One time, Chadzman on the left-hand side, lo estakel be, he didn't learn this parsha. V'nasav ime Roman, and he took a Roman police officer with him. V'lo higia la'ako achemochar hasus shalo. He didn't get to Akko before he had to sell his horse, because he had been accosted by so many bandits that he was broke. So what's the Medrash trying to tell you? The Medrash is telling you the story that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi says it's a good thing to listen to the Tanakh. In what way? In how you're going to conduct your present day affairs. And how you're going to interact with such an interesting story. So that's one model. The concept of using Tanakh as a blueprint. Now how do you interpret Tanakh? That's a further question. Here's another story, page 6. So this is a very interesting story, and the reason I think about this story is because of this series of books that some of you are familiar with. It's Rabbi Binyamin Lau's series, The Sages, Chachamim. So in here, essentially, the thesis of this book is to weave together the lives of the great Mishneic figures from the Pirkei Avos with the political and historical background of the time. And what you'll see is, as you study some of these volumes and some of these chapters, that there was a great amount of involvement, in many cases, of Rabbanim in political leadership. And this is one story that you have on page 6, maybe one of the more famous rabbinic discussions of this concept in different ways. And you see the complexity of it. Because the Gemara describes the story of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. That's probably familiar. It's probably one of the most famous stories in the Talmud. The story of a man who had a party, and instead of inviting Kamtza, he invited Bar Kamtza, and then Bar Kamtza shows up to the party, and what happens? The guy says, "Was titzachli, you get out of here." And apparently the aristocracy and the rabbinate were sitting there, and he offers to pay, and what does the guy say? get out. He picks them up and he throws them out. I mean, the Kamtza figure offers to pay for, excuse me, Bar Kamtza offers to pay for the whole meal, but doesn't matter. He says, I don't like you. So this individual becomes very, very, Bar Kamtza becomes very, very upset. So he goes tattletaling to the Roman government, and they send a carbon. He says to them, you see, the Jews won't accept your offering. It's, it's a rebellion. And what does he do? He puts a little blemish in the carbon to the point where it would not be noticeable to the Roman authorities. They wouldn't find it offensive. But according to the halacha, it wouldn't be acceptable. It was either in the lip or in the eyelid. So they come to the Beis HaMikdash, and now here comes the question. Interesting observation. What should they do with this sacrifice? So there's a debate between the Rabbanim in the Beis HaMikdash whether or not they should offer the carbon nonetheless or not. So there's a debate between the Rabbanon, who said, L'kruve mishum shalom malchus, and Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulis, who says it's a bad idea. Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulis says to the rabbis, you can't offer this sacrifice, because people will say you can offer blemished sacrifices. And they said, but then what are we going to do? Maybe we should kill this guy because he's a Moser. He's trying to destroy the Jewish community. He says, oh, you can't do that because they're going to say somebody who puts a blemish in an animal, you're going to kill him also. So what do? Nothing. And then who shows up? The Romans. So on the one hand, this is a halachic question. It's a question for a posek, whether or not you're allowed to offer a korban in the context that we're describing. But the way the Gemara frames it...
Besides the Romans showing up, what do the Romans do?
Well, then they destroy the Beis HaMikdash and essentially machrif the entire Yishuv. So now this is the punchline, exactly. So what does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai say? Excuse me, Rabbi Yochanan. We'll get to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan, who was Amoraim later in the time of Babel, Rabbi Yochanan, an v'sanuso, which does not mean humility in this context. It means timidness. Shel Reb Zechariah ben Avkulis hichriva es beisenu, destroyed our Beis HaMikdash, v'sarfa es heichalenu, and burnt down the sanctuary, v'higli sonu me'artzenu, and expelled us from our land. So how do I interpret that statement of Rabbi Yochanan? It was a psak halacha. And there is a principle, ein eitzah ve'ein tvuna neged Hashem. When there is a halachic principle at play, you can't get around it. There's nothing you can do. Ein chachma ve'ein eitzah ve'ein tvuna neged Hashem. If there's a halacha, that's the din. So somehow Rabbi Yochanan is saying that it's more than just a halachic debate here. There's an anvasanusa, there's a timidness, there's a wimpiness, or I don't know what exactly the word should be. There was a miscalculation. Now the question is this miscalculation in the area of halacha? The word anvasanuso sounds like it's a miscalculation from a political standpoint. That had they gone about it a different way, so it could be, no, it's only a halacha question. And the halacha question was whether they should offer the sacrifice. And Rabbi Yochanan is saying is, the Rabbanim should have listened to Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulis. They were correct in their opinion and not his. But the way that it's framed sounds almost like it was an error in judgment. It was an error in judgment for Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulis, and perhaps it was an error in judgment in the Chachamim. So this is an open question. And we have to be careful because, as the Alter Rebbe said, and the Alter Rebbe was the one who said, you don't ask every material question. These sages of the Mishnah, they were literally spiritual supermen. But we don't believe in infallibility. So perhaps this was an error. And here's another example of where this is going to, the story is going to keep playing out as the destruction unfolds, where you see the role that rabbis played in political decisions. Because the Gemara describes in the next section of underlines, Hava Behu Hanu Biryoni. There were Biryoni in Yerushalayim. Who are Biryoni? In American parlance, we call them warmongers. Warmongers. Ultra-nationalistic zealots. They're living in Yerushalayim, these warmongers, and meanwhile there's a big storehouse of supplies that could have outlasted more than a decade, the Gemara says, of siege by the Romans from some very wealthy people. But these people were inciting war, and they burnt down the storehouses, so now the city's facing famine, so there's a crisis. Amru, they said, who said? Amru Luhu Rabbanon!
The rabbi said to the warmongers, Nefeg v'navich shlomo b'hadayu, let's go and make peace with the Romans. Don't fight them. Lo shafkinu, but the warmongers didn't allow it. Amru luhu, nefeg v'navich krava b'hadayu, let's go fight them. Amru luhu rabbanon, lo mistaya milsa, it won't work. So why did the rabbis say it won't work? Maybe they said it because they had Ruach HaKodesh. Maybe they said it because they knew that the spiritual character of the people was not worthy of a miracle. Rabbi Engel spoke yesterday about Chizkiyahu, that Chizkiyahu witnessed this incredible miracle against all odds. The Gemara has elsewhere that when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who we're going to talk about in a second, died, he was greeted in the next world by Chizkiyahu. Wait a second, it's ironic. Chizkiyahu was the one who said against all odds, fight. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the one who said against all odds, fold him. So when do you hold him, when do you fold him? So I once heard a shiur when I was in Karen B'Yavne who pointed out that it depends on the spiritual temperature of the people. You know, how? What are your odds like if you know that the people are worthy of a miracle? If the Navi tells you, if Yeshaya says, don't worry, so you know what? You hold him. And it doesn't matter that there are 185,000 Assyrian soldiers at your doorstep. You hold him. And when Yochanan ben Zakkai is looking at things, he says, fold him. But it's interesting to me, this second step of the story is that who's having discussions here? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who we're going to introduce in a second, he was the relative of the head of the Brionim. And it's back and forth, back and forth. It's the rabbis who are involved. Now, it could be that there was a vacuum of leadership. But what we're seeing is that the Rabbanim are not just sitting in a base medrash somewhere, learning sugyas, and everybody else is making the decisions. You see that they're very involved. But you even see further the complexity, which is on the next page, which is that they come up with a plan, a scheme, to get Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai out of the city to go meet with the Romans and try to figure something out. So what do? They pretend as if he has died. They take him out for burial. There's a whole ruse how they're going to get him to do that. And ultimately, he makes his way to... Yeah. Makes his way. It doesn't tell you the place.
Wasn't it Yavne?
No, we're going to get to Yavne in a second. He refers to Yavne. It doesn't tell you the exact place where the Romans were. So I think it was this is Vespasian. So it doesn't say where he was, but somehow he got to the military camp of the Romans, and he knocks on the door. He wants to see Vespasian. So they have a whole discussion about back and forth. Was he the emperor? It turns out he was the emperor. He didn't know it yet. Okay. So what does he ask for? So he asks for three things in the underline. Yavne v'chachameha, which is going to be the refuge of the Yerushalayim center of learning. Number two, Shul Shilta de Rabbi Gamliel, the house of the Nasi, so that the patriarch could continue. And number three, a physician to heal Reb Tzadok, who had been fasting for a long time. So this was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's request, and Vespasian agrees. It's a political calculation. So much so that the Gemara then quotes a pasuk, either Rav Yosef or Rabbi Akiva, quotes a pasuk, in Yeshaya, Meshiv Chachamim Achar Vedatam Yisakel. Had they said it, I could read it. Had I said it, you would throw me out, and you should. The Pasuk says sometimes God confuses people, even the righteous, the wisdom of those who are very wise. He confuses it. It's a big mistake what he did here. What should he have said? He should have asked, one more chance, please. Just leave Yerushalayim alone. And what's the Gemara answer? What did he say in his mind? He says, Tafasta maruba lo tafasta. He's going to ask for everything and he's going to get nothing. So at least he should ask for this. So what do we have here? You have here a machlokas, a debate, not about a sugya, about whether or not the ox is obligated to pay, the ox is not obligated to pay. You have a discussion about strategy. It's a political strategy question. What they should be asking for in this crucial time. Because at the end of the day, it was this decision, according to the Gemara, that handed the keys of Yerushalayim to the Romans. And you see how the Rabbanim were very involved. So it's a very interesting second case. The first question was, you know, looking at Tanakh for a model. The second one is looking in the Gemara, and you see that the Rabbanim were certainly involved. So now the question is, well, how does it play forward? So one of the big discussions surrounds one Mar Makom, which I want to focus on now for the end, which is on page 8. Here's the story. The first Perek, a Maseches Sanhedrin, discusses the laws of the Beis Din HaGadol. The Beis Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim, which was comprised of 71 of the greatest rabbinic sages, sat in Lishkas HaGazis. The Rambam says at the beginning of Hilchos Mamrim, they were the Omur HaOra. They are the basis for all of Torah spreading out the world. Now, it happens to be that today we don't have the Beis Din HaGadol, but the Rambam writes in the Hagdama that even the Talmud has the authority of the Beis Din HaGadol because it was a centralized body of knowledge of all of the Torah wisdom of that time. Talmud Bavli, according to the Rambam, has the status of the equivalent of the Sanhedrin. So the Sanhedrin has many functions. It tries very severe capital crimes, lots of other things, and says the Mishnah the following: Ve'ein motzien lemelchemes harishus ela al pi beizdin shel shivim ve'echad. The king of Israel did not have the license to go to war for a voluntary war without the permission, the word of the Beis Din HaGadol. Certain wars, you don't ask questions. The Rambam says, Milchemes Mitzvah, the seven nations, the Canaanite nations, if you're being attacked, defensive wars, that's what's called the IDF. It's the Milchemes Mitzvah. That's a shiur for another time. We could have done that this morning. All right. No. Stuck with this. It's a Milchemes Mitzvah. So that's no shalas. You don't need a Sanhedrin for that. But if you want to go expand the borders of Israel, you are the king, right? You can't go so fast. So why not? So the Bartanuri here quotes from one opinion in the Gemara. The Gemara has three different levels. The Bartanura here, Ravadi Bartanura, quotes from the Pasuk Va'achre Achitovo ben Ayo ben Yoyada, which the Gemara Darshans refers to the Sanhedrin. You go on page 9, the first half of that Gemara tells a story. First it tries to bring a makar from a Pasuk, then it moves to a story. The story is, Kinor Hayatoloi Lamaila Mimitosa Shal David. There was a kinor. A kinor is some kind of instrument. I'm not sure exactly what kind of instrument it was, but I think it was a wind instrument. I used to think that a kinor was a harp, but I don't think so. Why do I say that? Because the Gemara describes that the kinor was hanging over the bed of David HaMelech, and the wind would blow, and it would wake him up. So it sounds like it was a wind instrument, or maybe it was a wind chime, but it's hard to believe that it was a harp, right? If you take a tube and you blow at a harp, it's hard to believe that that's going to do much. So all right, a kinor is the question of what that is. So David HaMelech would get up in the middle of the night when the wind would blow, and he would study Torah until the morning. Then the Chacham would come into this morning, and they would say, look, we have to go out, we have needs. Economically, we have to expand the land of Israel. So you know what he would say to them? He said to them, L'chu pashtu yedechem bigdud. So go conquer more territory. Miyad, what do they do? Yoatzim ba'achitofel. They ask Achitofel, who was the wise man. He was the military strategist. V'nim lachin b'sanhedrin. And they would ask the Sanhedrin, and then Vesholin Bu'urim Vetumim. So, what do you see from here? Before David HaMelech would go to war, he would ask the rabbis. So this is a model that would say that the rabbis should have some input on what the military, what the Defense Department is going to do when it comes to running the military campaigns. But what's interesting to think about, and what I want to consider and suggest for you to think about, is what is the role that the Sanhedrin is playing here?
If they're asking the Sanhedrin,
yes,
and then they're asking the Ur of the Tomb.
Great, perfect. So Rashi says the reason, so go back down to the bottom. What I gave you here, I gave you one Gemara because I could have given you two pages, but I was environmentally friendly. So what I did was this Gemara is a page in Sanhedrin. On the bottom, my volume of Oz V'Hadar has most of Rashi from a Gemara in Brachos. So Gemara in Brachos, Rashi answers your question. The last tiny letters on the bottom, just a little bit at the bottom, Urim V'Tumim Im Yatzlichu. The request from the Urim V'Tumim was not for permission, it was for the prediction. Right. It was for the prediction. Uh-huh. David HaMelech, you see this in Shmuel Beis. David HaMelech, before he goes to war, he'll ask the Urim V'Tumim, will we win this war? And they'll say yes or no.
But if the Sanhedrin says do the war, and the Urim V'Tumim says you're going to lose.
Great, so that's exactly my question. Why are they asking the Sanhedrin?
Right.
That's what I want to know. I want to figure that out. So Rashi here says, look in the Rashi, in the first underline, notlin rishus mehem. You have to ask their permission. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to the Sanhedrin, mm-hmm. right, for a bracha, you're going for permission. But Rashi in Brachos says, notlin mehem rishus kedei sheyispalalu, so that the Sanhedrin should daven for you. It's a little bit different. Why are you asking the rabbi? Why should the defense department call the chief rabbinate? Again, theoretically, I'm not speaking practically today. Do they need to ask permission? Or do they need to get a blessing? So the Rambam, in page 11, the Rambam codifies this halacha. He says, Milchemes mitzvah ain't it tzarach lito bo b'shus bezdin. A milchemes mitzvah, you don't have to ask permission of the bezdin. Ela yotze me'atzma b'choleis v'kofi ha'om laso lotzeis. And you can coerce the people to come. You can draft people to a milchemes mitzvah. When the Jews are being attacked, the government can say, we have a draft. Abo milchemes ha'rishus einu motzi ha'om b'lo ba'ela api bezdin shol shivim v'echad. You can only take the people out through the bezdin of shivim v'echad. So the question is, what is that role? So the Lashon, if you look on page 11, the Rambam in the Sharashim of Sefer Mitzvah said an interesting phrase. V'yadua sham milchamos v'kibush ha'aratzis lo haya ela b'melech. And look at that line. U'ba'atzas Sanhedrin Gedola. What does atzas mean?
Advice.
So that's one way of looking at it. But the Me'iri, Rav Menachem HaMe'iri from Provence, follows a careful reading of the Rambam. He doesn't mention it, but when we go back to the Rambam, you'll see it very carefully. Says the Me'iri, Hare elu milchemes harishus, I found this in, right there in his Chidushim on Sanhedrin, Ve'ein yachol lochov hesa'om lotzis ba, ela al pibez and shal shivim ve'echad. You can't force the people, you can't institute a conscription without the permission of the Sanhedrin. So that got me thinking, what's the pshat? So I think you can look at this, and it's a very big nafka mina, in three different ways. The first way is, you need their blessing. Why do you need their blessing? Because they are great spiritual giants. And if you get their blessing, you'll be more likely to succeed. That's like that Rashi and Brachos. The second pshat is, you need their rishus. Because you can't operate a military system without the input of the Gedolei Torah, without the Sanhedrin. They have to have a say. But there's a third option. What does it mean? Why is the Me'iri saying, and the Lashon of the Rambam mentions the same thing, that you have to ask the Sanhedrin to do what, Sigismund? To coerce, to conscript, to draft. According to this, it sounds like what he's saying is the reason why you need to go to the Sanhedrin is because you need the Sanhedrin's permission to force people to go to war. Again, theoretically, playing this out, if people wanted to volunteer for the service, maybe you wouldn't need to ask the Sanhedrin. Now, why would this be true? So here is a suggestion. Now, I didn't do enough research in the Achron to see if anybody else says this, but you'll tell me what you think of this shtickel Torah. Because Rav Shechter, Shalita, my Rebbe, used to say many times for Rav Soloveitchik, especially around this time of year, when he talked about Israel and the state of Israel and Tzahal and all these important topics, he pointed out that there is only one Jewish community, period. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out there's only one Jewish community, and that's the Jewish community of Israel. We do not live in a Jewish community. We live, a bunch of Jews, together. But we are not Knesset Yisrael. We are not Klal Yisrael. We're not. This Tuesday night, in Mirtz Hashem, hopefully everybody will join us. We have a very moving and very meaningful Yom HaZikaron commemoration. We do that because we want to mimic, to connect to what's going on in the real community of Israel. At Kins at 8 o'clock. We're just pretending. We're not real. The real community is there. We're not really a Jewish community. One of the functions of the Sanhedrin is to be the representatives of the Jewish community. If For example, and if you look at the side of that Rambam, which we don't have time for today, the Tziyunim mentioned that the Rambam also in the Sefer Mitzvos requires you need the Sanhedrin, the Great Sanhedrin, for Kiddush HaChodesh, for the calendar. And you ask yourself, wait a second, why do you need the Sanhedrin for Kiddush HaChodesh? It's not a adjudication. It's not a matter of adjudication. It's not a legal question. It's a calendar. You need just some good mathematicians. So I've shared a quote from Rav Soloveitchik, and it's really meduyik in the Lashon of the Rambam, that the reason why you need that is because not the Sanhedrin as rabbis, but as the Sanhedrin as representatives of the Jewish people. It's almost like the Congress of the Jewish people. They also wear the hat of greatest chachamim of the Dor Amr Aura, but they also wear the hat of what Rav Shechter used to call nitzigei Klal Yisrael, the representatives of the Jewish people. They represent everybody. And therefore, they have to decide for the whole Klal, which is all the Jews in Israel, when the calendar should be and when the Moadim should be. It's not like a halachic question, is electricity mutter, is it usser? It's what does the policy have to be for the Jewish people? So I was wondering if maybe that's the pshat in this Rambam. Maybe the reason why you need to ask the Sanhedrin is because if you're going to force the community to serve, you need to have the haskama of the community. If the shaila's mitzad instituting a draft, then it has to come from the will of the people. Once the people will a draft, then you can force them.
Yeah, but could they change the Urim
V'Tumim? No. So the Urim V'Tumim, that's going to tell us whether or not we're going to win or not.
So why not just go there?
It could be, but that's not a measure of license. This is going to be the strategy to decide before we go to the Urim V'Tumim, because you're alluding to the fact that you can't just go to the Urim V'Tumim stamazoi. Like the Gemara has a discussion, in a private person, if I have a question, I can't just go ask the Urim V'Tumim. The Gemara has a discussion, who can ask the Urim V'Tumim, and under what circumstances? It could be there's no point to go to the Urim V'Tumim if the Sanhedrin says it's not a good idea. If Achitofel says don't start a war now, so then don't go to the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim is a prophetic end to tell you what's going to happen. First, we have to decide whether or not from a Hishtadla standpoint it's appropriate to do. But to me, when I was looking at this Rambam, it's not so clear. Because many people use this Rambam as a raya and this Gemara as a raya. You see, you have to ask Das Torah before you go to war. But I'm not so sure, according to this far from Rav Shechter, from Rav Soloveitchik, that this is a function of Das Torah. Maybe it's like Kiddush HaChodesh, that it's a function of just being the representatives of Klal Yisrael. Memela, if that's all it is, so then you can have a referendum. Obviously, the Gemara says it's a din. You have to ask the Sanhedrin. It's a formal halacha. You require that. But what's the nature of that requirement, and what does it say to us? Based on how we're going to interpret this Gemara, it'll have significant application for how you view the relationship between the Rabbanim and the state. So I close with two essays that I'll share with you. One of them, I gave you the whole thing. The chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, the great Sephardic Rav Chaim David Halevi of blessed memory. So he has an essay that's published here in the Tchumen, volumes, in Volume Ches. It's very short. It's a truncated piece of something that he appears in his tshuvas called Aseh Lecha Rav, where he talks about this question. And he asks the question, Das Torah Be'inyanim Midinim. What's the role? So he begins with a half-truth, he says. People ask, is there anything, any shiloh that's outside of the realm of Torah? Is it possible? He says, some people claim there's a shiloh that's outside the realm of Torah. He says, you're half wrong and you're half right. You're half wrong because Torah sem shem tamima. Torah has everything. And anybody who doesn't believe that the Torah has everything about everything, that spiritual level, they're totally flawed and mistaken. But he says, you're half right because the Torah does not give you a system of commerce. The Torah gives you parameters, how you can't rip people off, how you have to establish, make sure that there are social fixes in there, but it doesn't tell you, by definition, whether a Torah society is capitalist or socialist. It doesn't say. It doesn't say how to set up a healthcare system according to the Torah. It gives you parameters about how you're obligated to help people who are poor and how you have to provide healthcare and hashiv to shivim and all these kind of things. But he points out that there is a lot of room. So therefore, what does he argue on page 14? He argues, it doesn't mean that there is no concept of Das Torah. So he quotes this Gemara in Sanhedrin. Rather, there should be a partnership where the values and the concepts and the meta-halachic sometimes also comes into the picture. And I'll close with one page on the last in 15. You can share it, read it on your own, or share it with friends and enemies. You can study it later. It's an article from this book called HaRabanut VaHamedina from the Gaon Rav Shol Yisraeli. Rav Shol Yisraeli, who was born in Europe near Minsk. His mother, I think, was murdered by the Nazis. His father was a Rav. I forget how he died. He made it to Israel, and he became a tremendous personality in the religious Zionist community. He was the Rosh Hashiva of Merkas HaRav for several years. He founded the Kol Eretz Chenda that some of us are familiar with in Yerushalayim, and he was a tremendous Dayan, a Gaon both in Halacha, in Chosh and Mishpat, and also in Machshava. He published a lot of different topics on a wide variety. And one of the chapters in this book discusses this question about the relationship, what he calls Hatnua Hadatit Lumit. So he's describing the Mavdal, the Mizrahi. And the title of this chapter is Bein Hamanhigut Datit Ruchanit Levein Manhigut Ma'asit Politit. Between religious spiritual leadership and practical political leadership. Exactly the question that we're raising today. And he says it's a complex answer. And these questions are complex. So on the page I gave you, on page 15, on the one end he says, yes, the rabbis have a say. So then they asked him, this was later, I think it was published also in HaTzofeh, Alafi Amur, so all the politicians, they have nothing else to do. They have no independence. Einu yachol liyos bal yozma atzmait mishalo. If you have to just listen to the rabbis, he says, no, not true. Because there is a partnership. Because he says many questions involve both rabbinic input, in his view, rabbinic input, and political savvy. And this goes back to the original Das Torah question. You know, not everybody, and this is something Rav Lichtenstein points out, not everybody who's a great Gaon in Torah necessarily has the sharpest political acumen. You know, you have Torah, you have Das, you know, who has Das? What is common sense? What is political savvy? So he says all kinds of questions come up. Questions about whether or not to go join the government, definition of miyuhudi, all these kind of questions. So Rav Shol Yisraeli argues in this essay that there should be some kind of partnership, that there's got to be a conversation, open conversation between the rabbinic leadership and the political leadership. And this is something that we should continue to think about. It's obviously a very complex question, and how it plays out practically is interesting. But thinking about the idea from these global perspectives, you know, the first notion that we had about the importance of Torah as the spiritual bedrock, the question about Das Torah and the breadth of it, and then looking at the different models from Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi studying Chumash. You know, I don't know if Ben-Gurion studied Tanakh. Maybe he studied Tanakh before he went to speak at the United Nations. I don't know. And then the Gemara about Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai and Rabbi Yochanan and the questions of how they navigated the revolt and how they dealt with the Romans. And then, furthermore, this question from the Gemara and Sanhedrin, which I think is the crux of the question of how do you understand the role of the Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin were rabbis. What role did they have in the government, in the Melech, in his decision to go to war? Depending on how you understand that Rambam, that'll impact the question of how the rabbinate plays in terms of the role and the state making its decisions.
I mean, the big problem, though, that it would be nice.